Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts.
Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Mary Kay Henry. Mary Kay is the president of the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, which represents 2 million people across US and Canada. Mary Kay, welcome to World of DAS.
Glad to be with you.
Okay, now this has been a very significant time to be a union leader, right? There's major movements in healthcare where you are, in airport service, in trucking, in food service, in auto, all over the economy. Why is this happening now? And this wasn't happening 5 years ago.
I think because essential workers who showed up every day to work during the global health pandemic understood that they were making a choice between their life and their livelihood to continue to go. And as we emerge from the pandemic and they witness record profits in some sectors of the economy, working people decided enough is enough. We deserve better. And I think that's why we're coming out of this amazing summer of strikes and into solidarity season this fall and winter.
It's been happening both with labor movements and with not like wages have gone up dramatically, especially in the low end. At least where I live, I've seen a lot of fast food chains, which maybe used to pay $14 an hour, now paying $20 to $25 an hour. So we're seeing just significant, very significant changes in just the last few years. Is it also just like an inflationary thing too, that's putting more pressure on some of these businesses and allowing giving workers more power?
I think it's less inflation, Aaron, and more about workers deciding what's worth it. Am I going to go risk my life for a $12, $11, $15 an hour job? And they withdrew from the workforce and wages went up in order to fill the amazing vacancy rate that we witnessed as we emerged from the pandemic. So I thought it was workers voting with their feet and deciding, hey, I can do better than this.
How do you think this is going to play out in the future? From one perspective, you say, okay, well, we were at like peak labor over the last 6 months. Obviously, that's probably not something you want. You want this to continue. Like, how do you think this plays out over the next few years?
I don't think it's going to slow down anytime soon. And now more than ever, I think working people are showing us that we need to rewrite the rules and allow for working people to join together and have a voice. I think what the AFL-CIO did this week with Microsoft, where they extended the right to organize beyond the gaming sector that they had agreed to 2 years ago to the entire footprint of Microsoft, is a game changer. And for me, that's a way in which a major corporation decides to rewrite the rules and allow workers to decide for themselves whether or not to join a union.
I'm not familiar with the Microsoft, so walk us through. That's interesting to this community. We're tech folks, which are not used to being organized.
Microsoft had a fight with the gamers for about 10 years, resisting their willingness to join a union. And then they recently achieved an agreement with the Communication Workers of America, where the company announced, hey, we've evolved. We are going to stop our union resisting efforts, and we're going to allow workers to decide for themselves. And that was called a labor peace agreement, where there's a set of agreements that the union and the employer achieve about when workers decide, they'll sign a card. If there's a majority of the workers that have signed cards for the union, the company will recognize them. And in some cases, they can go vote for an election, or the cards become the indicator of the votes. And so that example for the 400 gamers that Activision Blizzard employed, Microsoft extended that to the entire company. So it's true for the engineers that are working on AI. And
so if they choose to, they could decide to unionize or something like that.
Correct. Without the employer hiring a group of attorneys to resist workers deciding to join together.
If you're an AI, like a true AI engineer at Microsoft or OpenAI, I think the average person there probably makes $800,000 to $900,000 a year. Like, who makes sense to actually unionize in that context, in the context like Microsoft?
The workers will decide inside the company. The other aspect of the agreement, Oren, that I just wanted to get in is there's a discussion with Microsoft about how workers are engaged with AI engineers about the application of artificial intelligence that's being designed by Microsoft all across the economy, which is another great breakthrough from our perspective, where workers get a seat at the table in the upstream design of AI. And hopefully then it can be used to actually augment work and make it better, or free people from things that they've wanted to be free from for centuries.
Now, Republicans today definitely seem more pro-labor than the past. You have Senators Vance, Hawley, Rubio, others that seem much more sympathetic to unions than like their direct predecessor, let's say Vance versus Portman or something. Why is that happening now?
Well, I think in the case of J.D. Vance, it was incredibly opportunistic that he understood that the UAW workers that were on strike were challenging the record profits of the big three, the 40% raises that CEOs got in the same period that workers took a huge cut in their wages and benefits. And so I thought it was a very smart political choice on his part to join with the strikers in his community. I want to caution you, Oren, I don't think it's a shift in the entire party's position on unions. Most Republicans oppose raising the minimum wage at the federal level. Most Republicans have been supporting Amazon's efforts to defeat the warehouse workers in Staten Island that have been trying to get their first contract now for 2 years. I think we should see Vance as a test of whether he's going to pull more Republicans to a more pro-union support, which is what's unique about what he's saying.
I'd say the average U.S. person, if you just poll them, they would probably be very pro-auto union and very anti-teacher union right now. If you just ask the average American, why is such a divergence? Is there just something nice about the auto unions that we think about and they have just a good place in our heart? Or how do you see that divergence?
Well, I think the auto workers touched a nerve that many people feel about growing economic and racial inequality in our country. And when they struck and made the case that profits had gone up, CEO comp had gone up, but the second tier of workers, which is now more than 50% of the big three, were earning $16 and $17 an hour, didn't have a full retirement, they have a 401k, and they didn't have healthcare benefits equal to the legacy auto workers pre-bankruptcy. So I think that level of inequality, it resonated with people who are struggling to make ends meet. And I have to say, Oren, there isn't the distinction that you're making with teachers' unions any longer. Over 70% of the American public support workers of all stripes joining together in unions, because I think there's a deep sense that there's a elite group at the top of our economy that are doing better and better, while the overwhelming majority of working people struggle to make ends meet.
There is more of a distrust today of leaders in general, right? Whether it be CEOs, but I imagine even as a union leader, like a union member may have more distrust of a union leader. Like, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's distrust of institutions. The way I deal with it is by going into overdrive on communicating individually with our members and then broadcasting that through technology. That's one way. A second way is by getting every leader at every level of the organization. We have 70 executive board members, 300 local leaders. We have 10,000 stewards. We have 100,000 political activists, and on, that we have a way of cascading the communication at every level of leadership so that people can share a vision and mission that drives our action.
That's really interesting. I imagine it's super complicated. People don't usually ever do what the CEO says, but I imagine in labor, it's even more difficult.
There's a lot of debate and dialogue, and then there are votes on what we do. And so when people feel ownership over the decision, and it's not just my declaration, there's a way for that decision making to be owned and then communicated through the whole organization.
Now, union membership peaked as high as, let's say, 30% or so in the workforce in the 70s. Now it's maybe down around 10%. Do you see a path for that growing significantly over time? And if so, how?
I absolutely see a path. There are signals of hope happening all across the economy. We have 500,000 fast food workers that have set a table in California that are going to raise wages to $20 in April of 2024 and then be able to set standards on health and safety and racial discrimination and other issues that drive those workers each and every day. If we could replicate that and then build membership around it, it explodes organizing on the scale that we need to actually make a change. And in Minnesota, we have gotten 25,000 nursing home workers to a statewide table, and they're going to begin to bargain next year between the nursing home employers, the government, and the workers. And this is an industry that I cut my teeth on, Oren, as an organizer, and it took me 3 years to begin a unionization and then settle a first contract for 100 workers. So we're going to leapfrog to being able to do it for 25,000 workers in the same period of time. And if we could replicate that in every state where nursing home workers join together and build unions, we can then begin to actually go back to that 30% level in the 70s. And when there was 30% of the American workforce collectively bargaining, that was raising standards for people all across the service and care industry. And given that our economy is driven by 80% services and care work now, it's really critical that we create this new American labor movement. And I believe it's completely possible to both return to that 30% of workers bargaining together and go beyond it.
If you think about the 70s, it was pretty much the lowest percentage of immigrants in the U.S., almost any other time in the U.S., because basically the U.S. had not really been open since the 20s. It's very hard to get in. Maybe the mid-70s, we started to see more waves of immigrants coming to the U.S. Now, I think you have like 13 or so percent of the U.S. is immigrants. Obviously, a lot of people are children of immigrants and stuff like that. Part of the reason, you know, some people say the wages rose so much and there's so much power was there wasn't a lot of new workers coming in back then. I know the unions have a very mixed view on immigration. How do you think about immigration?
We think immigration is the heartbeat of the U.S. economy, and 30% of immigrants are doing care work for elders in this nation, and people are aging 10,000 a day, be turning 65, and we're going to need 3 million more care workers in the next 10 years. And immigration is going to be vital to that. Any building and construction trade union would say that in order for the infrastructure dollars that the federal government passed last year to actually be shovel ready, they need immigrants as part of their apprenticeship programs. And so I think this broken immigration system that we have today is a killer for the American economy and isn't dealing with what employers need in what we hear every sector, hospitality, healthcare, building and construction, et cetera. I really think it's time for us to update the immigration policy in a way that's both humane and deals with secure borders, but both things can be possible at the same time.
Because on the one hand, obviously just having more people would put a pressure to lower the wages a bit. You'd have more supply for labor. But on the other hand, you're right. Obviously, like the economy needs these people to grow. And maybe if you're growing, that's more of like a trickle-down argument. If everyone's growing, then there'll be more for the pie for everybody. I could see like a labor union going, I think in the past, I could be wrong, but maybe 50 years ago, most of the labor unions were like kind of anti-immigrants. And then they kind of shifted over time.
Our union was very proud of the way we moved the rest of the American labor movement in the late 80s, especially when Pete Wilson was attacking immigrants in California, and there was this huge proposition, and we were able to shift and characterize immigrants as hardworking, taxpaying. They pay taxes but can't enjoy any of the benefits, and that's been shifting over time. But I have to tell you, Oren, I don't think of it as trickle down. I think that wages go up when people join together. And we're very proud of the Fight for 15 movement, making a demand for 15 and then sweeping across the country. And now 26 million people are on a path to 15. But we still have 40 million plus people stuck at 725. And so we have to figure out a way, even as we embrace immigrants, to raise wages for U.S.-born workers as well.
I recently went to a fast food place in California, and right when I show up, there's a huge screen. And on the other side of the screen was a person, an actual live person, not an AI, a real person. And they were talking to me, and they were taking my order, just like someone who would behind the counter would be doing. And that person happened to be physically in the Philippines, but they were super friendly. They were very knowledgeable. They spoke perfect English and got my order. Obviously, they weren't the ones cooking the hamburgers. They were the ones kind of like dealing with it, getting the order right, et cetera. I can imagine, you know, if you get wage pressure and other types of things, you're going to see fast food places like maybe make more of an investment in these other front of the house type of stuff. Obviously, back of the house, more difficult, but front of house type of things to automate it. We might be able to raise the wage from, let's say it was $12 to $25 an hour. But if the number of people go down by half, is that a win? Or how do you think about that?
I think that we've got to embrace that technology is going to make things more efficient. And our key demand here, Oren, is that workers have a seat at the table in how the technology changes work. I remember a fast food worker saying back to a store manager when he was on strike, the store manager said, "We're going to replace you with robots." And the fast food worker shouts back to the store manager, "As long as I can help design the robot, because I have figured out how to do things faster than you taught me. And I have a wealth of experience to be able to share." A lot of fast food workers have dreams of other kinds of jobs that they had to give up on because they are trapped in a cycle of intergenerational poverty and don't have a schedule that allows them to go to school, even at night, because it's so just in time, the scheduling. I actually think what you just described, most fast food workers would embrace as long as they had a seat at the table and could figure out a way to then skill up into some other job that's being created in the next economy.
If today it takes, let's say, 7 people to run a fast food restaurant and it went down to 4, maybe that would be fine as long as they're enjoying their jobs more and they're getting paid more.
And it would be fine if together, government, business, working people had a way for the 6 people that got displaced to get other opportunities. And right now, it's all broken. There's no thought about the workers that get displaced. They're kind of thrown out the door and they're on their own. But in a union, workers would be thought about in terms of how to skill into another job. We have an agreement with Kaiser Permanente in California that has, I think, in California, 500,000 healthcare workers. Those workers are guaranteed employment security as a result of a collective bargaining agreement. And when AI or technology displaces the medical records clerks, those clerks are trained into the jobs that the employer has shortages for. And if we could have that kind of compact across the economy as AI transforms work, I think working people would embrace it because it then doesn't mean the precariousness of whether or not I can feed my family.
How do you think of gig work? On the one hand, there are a lot of gig workers who would maybe prefer to be in a full-time job. On the other hand, a lot of them probably see it as a feature where they can have more of a flexible schedule. They can figure out the hours they want to do. They can do that. I can imagine from a worker's rights, it could go both ways. Like, how do you think about it?
We're backing gig workers in California and Massachusetts that are organizing. And in Massachusetts, they just introduced legislation that we're trying to get Uber and Lyft to support that would allow workers to sit at the table with the companies and decide how to deal with the flexibility and minimum standards. And it doesn't have to be the current minimum standards as defined by law, But can we, together with the employers, create standards that make sense for the workers? Because there's a core group of this workforce that is doing this job full time, and it is the way people are earning a living. And there's another part of the workforce where this job is in addition to some other full-time job that people might have. I think we just need to be creative. And it's just another case, Oren, that if we had a collective agreement with the employers, I think we could figure it out. Because you're right. We've heard from workers that they want the flexibility, but they also want some minimum standards.
If you think about like just the decline in membership and attendance in general since the 70s in our society, we've seen a decline in church attendance, decline in the Kiwanis Club or whatever membership. It's like that bowling alone thing obviously also happened in unions. You think it's just like people don't want to be a member of a group? They're more individualistic than they were back in the 70s?
Well, I wish it was that benign, but the reason workers are not in unions is because of an attack. When Scott Walker was elected in Wisconsin, he systematically undid laws that allowed public employees to collectively bargain. So 500,000 workers fell out of unions because of his attack. And then he moved a right-to-work law, and then he attacked prevailing wages. And so I think 1.5 million workers in Wisconsin lost their union because of his attack on unions. DeSantis just did a similar thing in Florida. We, in the last 6 months, have lost 30,000 members in SEIU because of his attack. And then there's a Freedom Foundation.
How does the attack work? Is it just they have to opt in or instead of opt out, or how does that work?
The old rules were if workers elected to join a union, that the school district, the city, the county would bargain a contract, and then the contract would get renewed every 3 years. In DeSantis's legislation, the union is required by law to re-sign everybody every year. If the union doesn't hit a 60% threshold, it then is required to have an election and then a contract. So for the 1 million public workers that were covered by collective bargaining agreements, what's happening is that the rules are so onerous that the union movement is spending all of our time reorganizing people that we've represented for 60 years in Florida instead of trying to reach out to workers that are demanding to join together in unions. So it's a great way to tie us down, I would say. Another attack has happened at the Supreme Court level by the Freedom Foundation, which is funded by the Koch brothers. And it's a way to unwind home care workers and child care workers having a union. And basically, the attack was people should not be forced to pay dues. And it opened up voluntary membership. And that undermines the collective bargaining process in state by state and makes it much harder for us to get into states that are controlled by Republican governors and legislatures.
So some of the attack has been on unions and some of the decline has been this attack from, like, let's say, more conservative forces and stuff. How much of the decline do you think is due to the unions themselves or the union leadership themselves? Like, how much do the unions have to blame for the decline? If a company was doing $1 billion in revenues and all of a sudden is doing $500 million in revenues, yeah, there might be some societal forces, but sometimes they blame the CEO and the company itself too.
I think the labor movement shares responsibility, Oren, but I wouldn't say that it's more than like 15 to 30% of the problem, because any union that is not investing in organizing new workers is responsible for the decline of the labor movement. Because I assume, just like businesses, we have to continue to invest in growth in order to strengthen the current members' bargaining power that we currently have. It's why the UAW, just a concrete example, just bargained a big three contract, but is now opening up a major organizing campaign of the six non-union auto companies that operate in the U.S., Honda, Toyota, Kia, Tesla, et cetera. Those workers are now organizing together because they saw what the U.S. auto companies just did at the bargaining table, thanks to the auto workers' demands. And that's a way that the UAW is investing in expanding the power of workers in the economy.
There are some laws that just seem like odd, these non-compete laws for fast food workers or something like that. It seems like getting rid of some of these non-compete laws, at least for people that say like make under $200,000 a year, under $100,000 a year, that seems to have like very broad bipartisan support. Why can't we do some of these little wins?
Good question, Orin. Why can't we? It makes me crazy too. I think those things are so ridiculous. I mean, it's been the politics of the polarized debate at the national level that makes simple things like this, I think, harder and harder to do. We have been successful in some state level eliminating those non-competes.
New York has been terrible for years about non-compete, whereas California, I don't even think they have really. It's very hard to get a non-compete in California.
But we just eliminated it in California in the fast food sector, finally.
I didn't realize they had it in California in the fast food sector.
Oh, yeah. We had to move state legislation to get it done. It is a good point. That's why the Fight for 15 tried to begin to make progress on wages, city and then state, and ultimately trying to get to the federal level.
One of the reasons you can think that the tech sector has been so vibrant is there are basically no non-competes in the tech sector. So if you want to move from like Google to Facebook to Microsoft to Amazon to Apple, you can. Obviously, that's good for wages because people can compete for you for a job. But it's also very good for the tech sector itself because you're bringing in best practices. Obviously, you can't take any secrets with you, but you can build, okay, this is how we organize. This is how we built our code in microservices, which is kind of something that Amazon figured out in like the early 2000s and kind of exported to all these other places. It's just like little knowledge about how, and I can imagine that could be similar with fast food, or this could be like a really good thing for all the economy if people have a movement to move between jobs, between companies.
It's why we think sectoral organizing and bargaining is so critical, because it understands that sort of employer-based organization for the labor movement doesn't actually get at trying to both grow and allow for the kind of movement that's happening in this generation of workers. There's no longer the worker in the 30 to 40 year commitment to one employer in the next generation. And you're right. I think we have to figure out a construct and rules that allow for that movement.
Because a lot of these unions, it's like there's a seniority thing. So if you leave the company, even if you are at a very high seniority and you go to the competing company right across the street, which may all still also have a union, you're going to often get a much lower wage scale. You're not really incented to leave. The unions almost set up a world where like you don't have a lot of labor mobility. It does seem like that would depress wages, or you don't agree?
I don't agree, because it's not unions that establish those rules. Those are the collective bargaining rules that were written in the 30s that frankly have been broken for decades. And the big three and the UAW bargain, the UAW worker carries seniority across the employers that are union.
Oh, it does. Okay, so if I want to go from Ford to GM, I don't lose my wage.
No.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. Okay.
But that's because they figured out their own rules in a private agreement. That's true in Kaiser, by the way. A Kaiser worker can leave Colorado and move to California and carry their time and service with them. But that was mutually agreed. And it was a way, frankly, for Kaiser to incent workers staying with them rather than going to competitor healthcare systems.
Let's say I live in San Francisco. You'd probably be a flight attendant for United because it's one of the hubs. And let's say I really want to move to Miami. Miami, that would be a hub for American. And so if I want to go from United to American, I'm going to take a very big pay cut as a flight attendant, especially if I have 20 years of seniority or something. It really would disincent me from wanting to make that move.
Yes.
All right, interesting. Electric vehicles, they're a lot less complex to assemble than a traditional gas vehicle. And in some ways, that means it can make them cheaper to make. You need a lot fewer people to assemble because there's a lot fewer parts putting it together. Are there some sort of like tension between labor and the environment?
Historically, there have been, Orin, but I would say that in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of work done inside the labor movement and the environmental movement to say we need to think about a just transition from a fossil fuel-based economy where 3 million workers in the U.S. are union workers in that sector, and how do they transition to the clean energy economy, which is more non-union in the U.S. than it is in other parts of the world and is much lower wage. So I think a key question for the labor movement with the environmental movement is, how are we insisting on that just transition? In Germany, in Scandinavia, those countries have a tripartite agreement between the industry, the government, and the unions about how to transition the current fossil fuel workforce into the clean energy workforce and not have their economic livelihood drop. And you can imagine that's kind of otherworldly sounding to U.S. employers, but it would be totally liberating and it would catalyze the speed of the transition if we could deal with that issue.
Now, in 1968, the Teamsters endorsed Nixon for president. Maybe partially that was due. I think there was a backroom deal to get a pardon for Hoffa for the endorsement. There might have been some other weird backroom things going on back then. But can you imagine a scenario where like a major union in the future endorses a Republican president?
No, not in the current policy direction. And frankly, sort of hate-filled, autocratic direction that Republican presidential candidates are taking the country. And so I think we, as the labor movement, have to stand in this moment as a key bulwark of maintaining a democracy. And we have members inside of SEIU and across the American labor movement that are registered Republican, that vote Republican at the local and state level. We have those members participate in our candidate endorsement process when we ask questions or we test candidates. But more and more of the Republican members inside our union understand that the federal level Republican candidates no longer represent their interests. And I can't imagine that scenario, certainly not in this next presidential election, 2024.
But even, let's say, in 2028 or 2032, there's a candidate Vance or a candidate Holly or something like that. Can you see some of these unions? Or do you think it's even in the next 20 years, it's unlikely?
For me, it's not simply the candidate. And our members are smart enough to understand that there's a whole infrastructure and moneyed interest behind these candidates. And so if Vance were to totally be able to refashion all the operating agreements inside the Republican Party, maybe that could be considered. But I have to tell you, Josh Hawley tipping his hat to unions and workers while at the same time pumping his fist in the air for the insurrection, that's not a difference that can be reconciled.
You run an extremely complex organization. What advice would you have for other leaders, whether they could be running public companies, whether they'd be running large multinational NGOs, et cetera? You've been doing this for quite a long time. What advice would you have for them?
That's so exciting to be asked, because I would love for more companies in the U.S. to follow Microsoft's lead and to embrace the idea that the frontline workforce has a wealth of experience to contribute. And I would love to figure out with current leaders in the business leadership of the U.S. how we could embrace a style of unionism in a 22nd century economy where workers have a say, and that we close the inequality gaps in ways that other countries around the world are doing, but that we should be a leader in. And so my advice would be to go to the front lines and listen, and then create a mechanism for the front lines to have an organized say through their organization in the future of the company.
What do you think of things like a term limit for either a CEO, a leader of a union, leader of a major institution? Do you think that there's something about turnover and stuff that revitalizes some of these things? Or do you think if like someone's doing an amazing job, let's keep them going?
I think both things are true, Oren. And so we have several locals in our union where term limits are a part of the function of the union. And in some cases, I find them destabilizing the term limits because the term is 2 years.
Okay, so it's not long enough.
Yeah. And then when the term is 10 years, we're watching an experiment in one of our locals in Washington State where I think it had the impact that you're saying. It's fresh perspective. It added a sort of boost of energy.
To me, that makes sense for a CEO. Like if you think of Michael Eisner at Disney, he was there for 20 years. The first 10, he was amazing. The last 10, I don't think he was that great. Same thing with Jack Welch. So he was 20 years. First 10 were quite good. The last 10, not so good. So you could see a scenario where like 10 to 12 seems like the max. And then after that, they're not innovating as much afterwards.
Interesting. The key question is whether it's enforced or understood as a good leader. Hey, I need to pass the baton.
Obviously, in presidents, it was always just understood until FDR kept it going. And then we had to like create a rule around it. A couple of personal questions. Your friend and former colleague, LaFonza Butler, she was just appointed to be a U.S. Senator in California following the death of Senator Feinstein. I imagine that made you feel like really, really great.
Oh, yeah. It was thrilling.
I was very surprised by that appointment. To me, that just seemed like, you know, normally you pick like a politician. It's like before when we had an opening, I think he picked like the former attorney general or the current attorney general of California or something. That seemed a little bit out of left field to me, but you're much more in the know of politics. Was that surprising to you?
Well, I knew that Governor Newsom had deep respect for LaFonza's political acumen and strategy when she led our California State Council, and she led the local union of 400,000 home care and nursing home workers in California. And she was a key player in getting California to be one of the first states to move to a $15 minimum wage. So I knew that they had a deep experience together that was more than shaking hands at big events and stuff. But I agree with you, Oren. I was surprised. It was like reaching beyond current electeds or people that thought that was their due and lifting up somebody who is incredibly accomplished in her own right, but was certainly not a traditional pick.
Yeah, well, I thought it was quite interesting. We asked two closing questions to everybody. What is a conspiracy theory that you believe?
I thought to myself, I should have called you and said, okay, Oren, help me out with the range of conspiracies from which I could pick, because it's really not a world that I spend a lot of time in. The one thought I had was, I don't know if this qualifies as a conspiracy, which is that I believe in gaming the system, because I think the system is rigged against individuals and organizations like the labor movement. So I believe in that, that part of what we have to do as we fight to rewrite the rules or create new systems and structures so that everybody can thrive is that we have to understand that in the meantime, in order to unrig the system, we're gaming it at the same time. Does that qualify?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If I had to like assess your personality, we've become friends over the last few years and had many dinners together and stuff like that. I feel like you're extremely open to ideas, like much more open than you would expect a leader who's like in politics and like fighting every day to be. Like you're open to just hearing about things. You're open to hearing like what the other side's perspective is.
Oh, definitely.
It seems like you're even open to changing your mind about even very, very big issues. Is that something deeply rooted from like childhood and your personality, or like if you just think of a stereotypical political or union leader, you just wouldn't expect them to be that way?
I think it's rooted in my experience in the labor movement, Oren, that needing to be open to contrasting ideas in a period where I've been in a movement that has been declining my entire life. As we said at the top, we're now at 10%. And so it's made me open to figuring out how do we confront corporate power and structural racism. And when you're trying to take on those two big challenges, you better be open to a whole host of ideas because we have not been on a winning path.
It's easy to change your mind if you're losing, because then it's like, okay, well, I'm like, I might as well be open to... imagine you're a baseball player and you haven't been hitting that well, and someone's like, oh, actually move your shoulder a bit. You'd be like, oh, I'll be open to this. Like, why not?
So it's born out of a need to take big risks and fail in order to succeed for working people.
Interesting. All right. Last question we ask all of our guests. What conventional wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
The first thing that popped into my mind was take your time. I don't think the world, given the pace of change, allows for as much slow deliberation as maybe when I first entered the workforce 40 years ago. And I think a willingness to decide and act and fail and then recover and do something different needs to become much more conventional. Inside the labor movement, maybe, Oren, is more than in data. The need to sort of fail faster needs to be adopted so that we can grow workers' power and the level of inequality that families are up against.
That sounds like a cultural thing. Like, changing culture is very, very hard. How does one do that?
I think it's naming the culture that is and then helping people understand if we change, what could be possible together. That's how we are going to try and do it inside of SEIU. My secretary treasurer, April Verrett, is kind of the driver of this culture change right now. And I've watched her very deftly and brilliantly name the current culture and begin to get agreement on the features of the culture we want to create that will make it better for workers to have the power they need to change their lives.
All right, this has been awesome. Thank you, Mary Kay Henry, for joining us on Rebel Desk. By the way, I follow you at Mary Kay Henry on Twitter. I definitely encourage our listeners to engage with you there. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of DAS, and DAS is DAAS, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Oren, that's A-U-R-E-N, Oren, and we'd love to hear from you. World of DAS is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of DAS. Check it out at flexcapital.com.